It's so nice having you in the studio again because it's so much fun to talk with you.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
I want to start by talking with you about you. Are you from Salmon Arm?
No, I am not from Salmon Arm originally. I've lived here for over 20 years, but that still makes me a newbie. I was actually born in Vancouver and spent a couple of my early years in Trail, BC. My mom moved us out east, and I really grew up in Scarborough. And then as a teenager, we moved back out west, spent a few years in Alberta. I wanted to come back to BC, so after I finished school, we moved back to this area. My grandmother was here, my auntie was here, and it felt like home.
What got you into the arts?
When I went back to university, I took a Bachelor of Arts degree, and it was because I was very interested in the visual arts, and I really wanted to be a painter. I wanted to be somebody who used, you know, skills and abilities to express things in beautiful ways. That was really why I went back to school. On the side, I thought, how can I actually make money doing this? So I was taking an education degree, actually, with an arts major. But at a certain time, the degree that I was taking changed to be a five-year degree, and I only had enough student loan to get a four-year degree. So I just took a Bachelor of Arts. And it really was kind of a struggle to think, well, now what do I do with this? And my partner and I actually purchased some screen printing equipment. We ran a screen printing business for 8 years and had a lot of fun doing that. It was a very creative industry for us to be in. And then in Salmon Arm, I saw the job posting for the Arts Council way back in 2002 and decided to apply because arts administration, fortunately, because I did my degree was at a liberal arts institution. So, which means you had to have a lot of different kinds of courses and learning. And arts administration was part of that. Things like grant writing were part of our discussions. And so I thought I was appropriately qualified for that job, and I got it. That was great. So I started working for the Arts Council in September 2002. And then the Art Gallery, within about 6 months, had funding to hire a part-time staff person for their first time. And so I was working part-time for the Arts Council, part-time for the Art Gallery for a couple of years until we merged the two organizations. And yeah, I've been there ever since.
Well, it used to be called just the Salmon Arm Art Gallery, but now you refer to it as the Arts Center.
Right. So the building has quite a long history. Of course, it was built in 1937 as Salmon Arm's first post office, and then it became the library. And then in 1994, the Art Gallery Association had existed for a couple of years already, and they were really looking for a home. And they had their eyes on a couple of different locations in Salmon Arm. But that building, when the library moved over to the mall, the building became available. The city owns it. They still own it. And a lot of people were lobbying the city to do all kinds of different things with it. Fortunately, Tom Brighouse and Ian Wickett were on council. Like Ian was mayor. And they were friendly to the cultural sector. And so it gave a little bit of time for the Art Gallery Association to get together a proposal to take over the lease of the building. And they were successful, and they had it for about a year before they realized, you know, it's really a lot of work to run an entire building when really we were really excited about this upstairs gallery space. So they invited the Arts Council to partner with them in the running of the facility. And so the Arts Council, who had their office right up at the community center at the time in the basement in a closet, basically, was happy to get out of there. So they came. And then the Arts Council took over the lease of the building, actually, so the gallery could focus on just gallery operations. And then the lower level, which the Pottery Club inhabited, and there was a studio space in the basement and other user groups, you know, it kind of became collectively the Arts Center, because not all of the space was art gallery. So over time, after the amalgamation, the Art Gallery Association itself dissolved and became part of the Arts Council. So the Arts Council as a society decided that, you know, we have to kind of place brand the building so that people know what we're talking about when we say things happening in the gallery, things happening in the Arts Center. So it became Salmon Arm Arts Center as a building. So now that's what we refer to. And we kind of call ourselves that as a society as well, because people just don't know, like, Arts Council, what do you guys do? So Art Center feels like a place-based kind of idea. And then the upstairs, where the gallery is still called Salmon Arm Art Gallery, because that's a very specific space for for visual arts exhibitions.
The Arts Center covers quite a lot, not just art and pottery anymore.
Oh, absolutely.
When did WOW start?
WOW started in 1994. So we're in the 30th year.
Wow.
I know. WOW is right.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. And the Arts Council, that's what the Arts Council's job is, right? The Arts Council is an interdisciplinary organization designed to do arts-based community development and to, you know, feed and encourage participation in the arts. So it doesn't mean just visual art. And that's a big difference between an art gallery, right, whose focus is on visual art. The Arts Council's job was to enhance music, theater, dance, literary arts, you know, all these other things in the community. And whether or not they had their hand in presenting those kinds of events is, you know, changed over the years, because the Arts Council was formed in 1970. So, you know, other societies were born since then, like Folk Music Society, Shoes Up Theater, like all kinds of societies have popped up to take on the roles of being the leads in those particular sectors. So the Arts Council doesn't necessarily have to provide all the music ideas, all the theater things, all the dance things, all the opera, right? Other societies manage those things, but we're still an interdisciplinary organization that wants to bring the broad sector of the arts together and have lots of ways in for lots of different communities to be able to experience the arts.
Seems to me that since you took over, the Arts Center has grown.
Yeah, I think it has. I think I might be ambitious. Like, I think I might see a lot of opportunity in terms of engagement, and I just get a lot of crazy ideas, and I get a lot of people who are up for participating in my crazy ideas. So I'm really lucky, I think. You know, these last 20 years have been a period of exceptional growth for Salmon Arm too. And I'm part of a number of communities of people who just really like to see, you know, fun things happen and to see creative placemaking, right? More public art, more opportunities to learn, more ways to connect. Like it's not just me. There's a whole bunch of people that are super keen on that kind of thing. So every time I do get an idea, we kind of tend to end up doing it. And then over the years that builds, right? Some of those ideas that were one-time things have become ongoing programs. And so it just keeps growing and expanding, and we're always growing. And I don't see, like, it's not like a physical growth where we have to expand and, you know, we're not creating widgets or anything. Like, there's no sort of space where we would think, oh, well, we're big enough now, we can stop now. Because there's always adaptation, there's always transition, there's always change. And so we can change programs, we can adapt programs to fit how the community's feeling and what the community's up for.
Do you have any programs in particular that stand out as your favorites or that have made the largest impact?
Oh, that's probably
a tough one, I know.
I have a lot of favorites. I loved doing the mosaic at Ross Street Stage. That was a five-year process. From the first conversation I had with Cindy Durkaz on the street, right in front of that stage, where she said to me, "What are you going to do about that space?" I know. It's like, I'll think of something. But that was the beginning, and the research and the fundraising and the design and the consultation took years. And then when we finally were physically doing it, it was a wild summer. You know, I spent really like 13 weeks pretty much focused entirely on the mosaic. But I look at that every day on my way to work. I love it. And I can remember each individual who created each little piece of that. And I love how people own it, you know, like they feel invested in it. It was a favorite time, and I have a lot of favorite memories from that. There's been other public art projects that I've done that I think are so important that I get to see the legacy of all the time. I think the Pride Project is something I'm super proud of, because I've seen such an impact in Salmon Arm from that project. And I love doing every single part of that whole project. So yeah, I mean, I could literally go on and on. Like, I've had some wild, wild times. And like, there's a partnership we did with Salmar Community Association called Exhibition on Screen, where we had a party, a reception on a certain theme, and then all trucked down to the theater to watch a movie about Van Gogh or about Edward Munch. And it was amazing. Like, it was such a beautiful series, and we had such a good time. April in Paris. That was, I mean, I'm sorry, you can't stop me. I mean, I just got so many favorites. I mean, really, how much time do we have? I should write a book.
You should write a book. You mentioned when you first got a part-time job. Now, things have grown since then, and now you're hiring people.
Oh, gosh, yes. I was the only staff person for the first 6 years I was there. And then I remember at a retreat, because we had board retreats where we'd sit around in someone's living room and eat food and think of things. I remember saying, I don't want more hours, because I was like being paid for like 25 hours a week or something. I said, I don't want more hours. I want help. Like, I just couldn't really imagine continuing to do all aspects of the job by myself anymore. And so, yeah, we hired a person. and so it's grown. Of course, like, we do have contractors. We have people that work seasonally, and we have people that work like one day a week. But we have three full-time staff now. Well, full-time being 30 hours a week. And that's a big change from the early years. And we have four other sort of contract staff who are there to facilitate certain things, a contractor to run WOW, you know, things like that. There's a pretty big growth. And when I look at the budget, one of the things that our new executive director, Christy Watson, shared early in our conversations was, your budget is a narrative. You know, it shows where you value things. And so when I look at our budget now compared to our budget when I first started, like, it's bigger. It's much bigger. But we're doing so much more. We ran three programs when I started. Now we run 13 programs. And they're bigger, more expensive programs too, right? And we hire more people and we pay artists. Oh my gosh, back in the day, we didn't pay anybody for anything. And so now we pay artists to do things. We pay musicians to do things. It's important. We've come a long way in terms of valuing the people who are contributing to this whole idea.
The Arts Center is located on a corner, mm-hmm. and surrounded by two streets, actually, right?
Yep.
And you have businesses opposite you. Are you in contact with any of those businesses?
Well, we really only have the lighting shop across the street from us, in terms of like closed businesses and on McLeod. And then across on Hudson, we have Inclusive Arts. I mean, we have a great relationship with Inclusive Arts, of course, because they're an arts-based business. So Barb and us, like, I mean, we're family. We just kind of, we do a lot of things in collaboration. And yeah, Barb's a really wonderful supporter. And the lighting shop is like, you know, they're kind of a different demographic, but, you know, they're friends. We buy our light bulbs there. So we just, you know, we just go over and we're like, yeah, we need this, and they know what we need. And so, you know, it's a good relationship. But we rely very heavily and meaningfully on the downtown businesses for sponsorships for Wednesday on the Wharf and for exhibitions and, you know, other one-off events. So I think we have, you know, built some really good, respectful relationships with the businesses downtown, and not just our neighbors. Of course, we've had Wildcraft, who's just recently moved, that used to be across the intersection from us. And Amber's been an amazing supporter of the Pride Project, for instance, over the last 4 years. And so I feel like, you know, we have a commitment as a society to do our business downtown with these people, because they support us. So we support them. We buy our stationery at the stationery store downtown, and we buy our lights at the lighting store across the street, right? Like, we buy supplies from the downtown businesses. Those are important relationships to maintain. If we want them to support us, we better support them. I feel like the downtown is a neighborhood, just like any other neighborhood. There's things to do. There's places to go. There's people you know. There's people you see every day. You're invested in how it looks. You're invested in keeping it clean and making sure that people feel pretty happy and safe in that area. So it's a neighborhood, and we're all invested in that. Like, everybody who goes downtown, not just the business owners and the people working in the various offices, it's everyone who uses the downtown is invested in that neighborhood.
One thing I wanted to mention to you or bring up was that you have a meeting of arts groups in town on Zoom.
Oh, yeah, the Shoeswap Arts Roundtable. So it's actually quarterly, so it's not mm-hmm. very frequent anymore. I think at the beginning of COVID, we ran it monthly, and then it became every second month, and now it's quarterly. because people are busy and they're getting back to in-person events and they're getting back to doing a lot of planning and adapting. So we understand that, you know, having to carve out an hour every once in a while is still kind of a challenge. But those roundtable events are very specifically for that networking opportunity that you used to be able to rely on the street corner for. Or events that we all would go to, right? Like if everybody went to the film festival, and so you would just end up working, right? Because you're talking about what your plans are, and let's talk about this, and hey, are you guys doing this? But some of those aren't happening right now. So the roundtable is kind of especially to network.
And whose idea was this?
Well, I mean, to be honest, that was us, but it's not an original idea. ArtsBC started doing the roundtable calls at the beginning of COVID, and after the first two, they were weekly. After the first two, I was like, gee, this is like really helpful. And I feel like we're not only being able to share the resources that we're finding and saying, you know, what does this look like for us now? We're doing technical and video and audio things that we never used to do, and where can I get these resources? What works for you guys? Like, not only was it that sort of adapting to COVID thing, but the support, like the being able to just say, we're struggling with this right now. And other people saying, oh yeah, we went through that 5 years ago. We can offer you some advice. And that was really important. And I kind of forgot how important that connection was with other arts professionals. And in our community, we have, you know, I think at one time the Arts Council had 33 different member groups that are all arts-based groups. Like, there's 33 different societies operating mostly in isolation. So, you know, let's provide the opportunity to talk to each other more often anyway.
How did the art gallery survive through COVID? Because there was a shutdown, people didn't want to get together, people needed to be distant, and here you are with an enclosed space.
Oh yeah, well, we pivoted pretty good, I think. We went crazy online. Like, we did an online exhibition. The planned exhibition that we had to cancel was called Resistance and Revolution. And we had previously run a protest sign workshop. So we did an online protest sign making workshop initially, and then kind of ran some of the content that we had planned for that exhibition online. We did interviews. We did a whole series of interviews with leaders in the community. We revisited some of our themes from the previous year, like the bird exhibition flight. It was spring, so we did these interviews, Zoom interviews that we recorded with birding experts and trail people, and sort of like we brought back ideas that we had already built relationships around and then did these online interviews. I mean, I'm so lucky that I had Kate Fagervik working for the Arts Council at the time, because she reinvented Family Saturdays and basically turned each family into their own little movie studio, giving them sort of the resources and the guidance to make their own Family Saturdays video at home with their own project. So the kid was the star of the video, and it was great. So we posted those on our YouTube channel. Like, we kind of went ham on that, on that tech side. So we certainly didn't stop working like a lot of people thought we might. And then when we got the go-ahead to open up again, it took us 6 weeks to kind of really get ourselves together to actually build the exhibition program again and build up events. And it was too late to run WOW that year, because it was May 30th or something when we got the go-ahead that we could start planning again. So we still did the WARF sessions. So we made an album. Like, that was new for us, to make a digital album. Yeah, and we were able to open in August with the new exhibition, The Forecast. So it was a crazy amount of work in that time. Like, I just felt like I was still running hair straight back, but I was learning at the same time. And so was Kate. So the two of us just kind of, you know, we adapted. We learned a lot of things about audio and digital and YouTube and like, you know, what does online content even look like? And what were people really responding to? People weren't always online, right? Like, they didn't want to, I don't know about you, but I didn't necessarily want to watch a symphony online, but, you know, I was definitely listening to more music. So like, we just kind of had to think about that, about what we were going to put our energies into in terms of video and audio and content. And then we also ran the Random Acts of Music program, but we adapted it for the young musicians. If you don't know what Random Acts of Music is, it's where we have young musicians roam around the downtown on a Wednesday, just playing music wherever. Well, the way we adapted is we sent those musicians, those young kids who were amazing, to the parking lots of care facilities, and they did parking lot concerts, and the people in the care homes would come out to their balconies to listen to the music. So there was lots of ways we could still offer live arts events. We just did it you know, very mindfully of the restrictions of the time.
Are any of these events still happening? Did you keep any of them?
I think everything continues to be adapted, right? So some of them still exist, but they were adapted again. You know, once things opened up a little bit, we adapted again. And sometimes the program kind of finished its purpose, and so it just quietly went away. But it really was giving birth to something, and they expanded, and we had to get bigger and better. Things just keep changing.
Are any of the videos still available on your YouTube channel?
Oh, yes. You can find everything on our YouTube channel, Salmon Arm Art Center. And then if you go back, we did a couple of Facebook Live events and Instagram Live events, so you can find those. Yeah, I do a little digging in our YouTube channel. It's pretty fun to look back at some of the crazy stuff we did. There's a lot of content there. And I mean, and it, like, some of it's ridiculous. Like, and it's just like watching some of that early COVID stuff. You're like, oh, did we really do that? But it's still pretty fun. And everything's pretty tidy and short. And there's nothing crazy length, movie length, you know, sort of stuff to watch. Everything's pretty quick. But some of the Family Saturday videos, oh my God, they're so good. Like these kids doing basically like science experiments in their kitchen. And their mom is the videographer. And so good.
So what's happening at the gallery now?
Right now, we have an exhibition called Environments for Reading, and this was inspired. So speaking of stealing ideas, so there's an artist, Evelyn Roth, who had a piece in the Vancouver Art Gallery called Environment for Reading. Totally stole her title. But Evelyn is an artist who uses upcycled materials to create like sustainable sculpture, and it's so fascinating all the stuff she does. And this particular Environment for Reading was made from upcycled sweaters, and it's a knitted, like a, looks like a bit like a tent. Had a little light in it and a little rug. And I just thought, oh, when I saw that, I'm like, we can totally do this. Like, I know that my community is super keen to do this because we have a wonderful, crazy fiber arts community out there, right? Like people who do felting and knitting and crocheting and sewing and quilting and, you know, just anything fiber. The domestic arts has a very specific creative aspect here in Salmon Arm. I found lots of people doing really innovative things. So I brought the idea to a group of fiber artists who were part of the Little Lake and the Knitted Tree, because as you know, we've done other fiber arts installations, and said, here's an opportunity for you to use your own media, your chosen media, to create an environment for reading. And my parameters were it had to be a soft sculpture, like something soft, and it had to be something a human could crawl into to read a book. So we have six artists in the show, plus I had one knitter who said to me on Worldwide Knit in Public Day, she's like, well, I can't do a whole pod, but I think I would be able to help somebody. Maybe I could just knit like a panel or something. And I said, oh, this is funny you mentioned that, because we have a collaborative project, which I was totally making up on the spot. And you could knit a panel that's like 7 feet long, and I will combine it with other knitted panels that are 7 feet long, and we'll make a special collaborative pod. So then I put that whole thing together. So now we have five collaborative knitted pods made up of 44 panels that were made by 21 knitters over the last like 8 months. And they're spectacular. They're so beautiful. And then we also have an additional collaborative pod, which I've called a place for the pollinators, because it is made from felted mats that were used for the pollinators exhibition collaborative sculpture last year. And then that fiber was used in the Little Lake. It was just dyed green instead of the blue in 2019. So I'm just reusing materials over and over again until I just can't use it anymore. So we actually have 12 different now environments that you can sit in the gallery and read your book. And you're welcome to do that. We encourage people to bring a book, take your shoes off, plan for an hour or so, and sit in the quiet and read.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah, it is really neat. And it's a beautiful show. The, I guess I shouldn't say that I'm not surprised. Like I'm never really surprised by the inventiveness of artists in this community. I know that they've got this twinkle of imagination that, and they imagine the impossible. And then somewhere between reality and impossible, this beautiful artwork emerges. And that's what's happened in this show. Like just some really stunning work.
This was 8 months in the making?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that most artists worked for the last 8 months on things, but the collaborative project, I launched it last January, And just by the time I got all the promotion and, you know, materials out there into the world, it was probably the spring. And then, you know, delivery of all the panels was January 9th. So it was less than a year. The artists who are in it had a full year, a little bit more than a year from the time where we made a plan and then the time that the delivery was.
Well, if this project took 8 months for the artists to do and you started it last year, like how far in advance do you actually plan all your different exhibitions?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I'm always working on about 6 or 7 or 8 exhibitions at any given time. I usually work about 18 months in advance. So if I've got an idea, I'll just kind of toss it around a little bit to different people and different artists who might be involved. I want to make sure it aligns with our goals and our mandate. And you know, we have a 3-year strategic plan that, I mean, it's basically become like a forever strategic plan because of the, you know, equity, diversity, inclusivity principles within it. And I want to make sure that everything we do, every exhibition we do aligns with, you know, our goals of challenging and educating and inspiring people and to be addressing relevant social issues. So as the community changes and the things that are important to us keep coming into the conversation, that just keeps feeding ideas to me. And I come up with these exhibition plans kind of based on some of those social issues. Yeah, I would say the concrete plan is always about 18 months in advance, but I'm thinking usually 2 to 3, maybe even 4 years ahead in terms of what we're going to be presenting.
Wow.
Yeah, it is a little bit crazy sometimes, I can tell you. Like in a single day, I'll have worked on 4 or 5 different exhibitions in terms of like artist communication, contracts, content, grant writing, whatever. Like it's just kind of always, there's always a lot of irons in the fire.
Has your latest exhibition opened?
Yes, it opened on January 26th. So we've been open for a week or so here. And then it goes until March 23rd. So it's a 2-month exhibition. And then we're going to have actually a 2-week shutdown because what I have discovered is having a week between exhibitions is actually not enough time. We had some time to put this exhibition up and it was down to the wire. We literally had 3 weeks to put this show up and it was close. Like I was literally still doing labels and signage on Friday before we opened on Saturday. So we have decided to give ourselves just a little more grace to have 2 weeks between some exhibitions. So not all, but some exhibitions will have 2 weeks. So over the Easter weekend, we're going to be closed. And then when we open up in the spring, April 6th, it'll be with the TSREP exhibition. T-S-R-E-P. It is Sohat McCheen for tree.
Ah.
So the exhibition has Indigenous and settler artists all about the displacement of Indigenous trees and shrubs from the Shuswap area. It's going to be fascinating. There's a lot of trees and shrubs that do not exist in town anymore because they were cleared for development or because, you know, in the last 20, 30, 40 years, the climate has changed enough where those trees and shrubs can't live here anymore. So we're exploring some of that.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah. And in fact, it's part of a 3-year plan that I have to bring all of these kinds of issues to the forefront. So the first one is called SREP, and it is about the Indigenous trees and shrubs. The second one is called Kuma, and it is about Indigenous food plants and animals. So like the salmon and things like that, and those aspects being displaced. And then the third year is the displacement of Indigenous people. So we've got a 3-year plan to address that those issues within the visual arts, using the visual arts. And yeah, it's kind of another thing that I think about is connecting exhibitions so that we're growing and learning between exhibitions on a certain topic. In a way, that's how the Pride Project evolved too, right? Like that was initially a 3-year project with an exhibition each year of different lengths that were addressing certain aspects. And the first year was just all about terminology and learning, right? It was all about like, what are we even talking about here? What does safety even mean? And you know, what do all these words that are new to a lot of people, what do they mean? And what are some of the stories from some of the people who are in the LGBTQ community here in Salmon Arm? So it was a very, you know, mild opening conversation. And then the next year we did Breaking the Binary. So we talked about the gender binary and saying, you know, not everybody identifies as either male or female. There's a whole lot of, you know, space in between there. And so that was the next step of learning. And yeah, and then the third year, it was a place to belong and was understanding more about safe space. So yeah, there's always an evolution planned. When I do any planning that's long-term like that, I want the community to find all sorts of ways into that conversation. I never want to be somebody who, you know, slaps people in the face with information. I don't want to say, you need to believe this or you need to think this. I want them to just start the conversation. And sometimes you can do that very gently and beautifully, but then there's always that opportunity to challenge and get a little bit more specific and more complex with the conversation. So I kind of like to weave in the exhibitions over year after year to do that, to start it slow and then to ramp up and make it a little bit more challenging.
That's three projects you have running ahead. Is there more that we can expect?
Oh gosh, yes. I'm working with Elaine Holmes at the school district for a youth curatorial, like basically a curating 101 for young people. So we're going to run a course for curating for four young people that will culminate in an exhibition where we're dividing the gallery up into four spaces and they get to curate their own little show using the work of their peers. That's a process. That is not a what we call a plonk exhibition where you just like throw some work up on the wall, right? Like we don't do those anymore. And I think a lot of people think that that's what happens at the gallery, that magically art appears on the walls and that people who have art under their beds can just bring it in and hang it on the walls, right? But that is so not what happens. Like it is such a important process for us to follow in a really authentic way. And I guess I know I'm using words that are a bit overused right now, but it's just so important that everything we do is connected to the here and now and things that are important to our community and things that provide opportunity for our community, opportunity for engagement, opportunity for connection, and opportunity to learn. And youth are a big part of that conversation. Like we need to make sure that they always know that their community art center is theirs. It is their art center, their art gallery. And they should never feel intimidated to walk through those doors, no matter what community they live in. So the ways to do that is to provide opportunities for them to be engaged at the core level, right? Like at the beginning where we're imagining exhibitions and where we're planning and we're talking to artists and building relationships. They need to be part of that process. And so I think it gives them a bit of ownership over what we do and gives them a little bit of added edge when they go out into the community and realize, or out into the world, and then realize they have these powers to create larger community-based arts things. So that's important to us. You know, the relationships with Indigenous communities, critical to what we are doing right now. This is the issue of our age, right? Reconciliation is... everything should be about decolonizing practices. And so we've been working really hard for the last 12, 13 years. However, I've been very fortunate to have the friendship of Louis Thomas and Jerry Thomas and Mary and a number of other amazing Indigenous folks over the years who've been so generous with me and with the Arts Council in terms of sharing guidance and knowledge. And so it's made it possible for us to address some of the calls to action in the Truth and Reconciliation Report. And so we do. We have the Truth and Reconciliation, the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation ceremony at the Arts Center every year on September 30th. We use Sahuapmic words in our exhibition titles and in some of our delivery of the programs. Astrid, who hosts at WOW, she uses Sahuapmic greetings throughout her whole introduction, and she's learning the language from Louis. So we're trying to build into our programming and everything we offer knowledge of this land through our Indigenous communities. That's a really important kind of aspect to what we do, and it's long term. Like you don't just phone somebody up and say, "Can I use this Sahuapmic word in my program?" No, it's got to be Indigenous led. They've got to have an investment in what we're doing in order for it to be real. And so I want the leadership, for us it's the Nisqually, the Switsmalf people, I want their leadership. I want them to tell us what to do. And so when I do get some of that, I go crazy. I just like, yes, we can do that. We can support that. And then I integrate it into whatever we're doing. And I do whatever I can to support it administratively. We can find funds for things. I'll do it because, man, like white people have had their run. We've had the benefit of a system that has oppressed Indigenous peoples for 150 years. I'm pretty sure we can spend the next few years stepping aside a little bit and highlighting some of this incredibly important land-based knowledge that is right here in our community, and we can learn from it.
What do you feel are the benefits of having the art center in the downtown core?
One of the benefits that the art center has for the downtown is that it is a place to go where you don't have to buy anything. I think it's important to recognize that in every neighborhood, you need places where you can go, that there's no pressure, there's no expectation. It's really just relaxing. You can hang out, you can meet a friend. You know, you don't have to feel like you, you know, just need to cough up money. There's definitely an accessibility aspect to that. And we want to make sure that the art center is always accessible. So if you don't already know, admission to the gallery is by donation, which is totally optional. We love it when people donate. We love to see you even if you don't donate. It's an accessible public space. You can come in there, meet a friend. You can see the show or not. Doesn't really matter. You can use the washroom. We have really beautiful washrooms. But the important thing is you don't have to buy anything there. And I think every community, every neighborhood needs more of those kinds of spaces. Just a place to hang out, which is what the library was too, right? Wouldn't it be nice to have a branch that's just the downtown branch of the library? It just feels like there should be more recreational spaces like that, where you can just go in, hang out, have a free coffee maybe. Like a friendship center for everyone, which I know is Louis's dream too, a multicultural friendship center. But I think we need like 10 of them in the downtown to really help build that connection with people. Each year we have at least one open exhibition, which is open to everyone, any age, anybody doing any kind of artwork of any kind has some opportunity to participate in an exhibition. Sometimes the format is size related. This year, the exhibition is called Le'enk'tuch, which means how are you in Sohwet McCheen. And it's a 24 by 24 show. So if you saw the 20 by 20 show or the 18 by 18 show, you'll know exactly what I'm looking for. I want artwork that is 24 inches by 24 inches only, 2D, and it has to hang on a wall. So then we hang it in a grid. So it looks like a giant like grid of art. It's amazing. It's so spectacular that I just love it. And I could do this every 2 years if I could, but we're trying this, you know, on an even year, 2024, to make the canvas purchase easier. But you can make pretty much anything, any media, as long as you make it that size and put it in the show. You can put up to 6 works in. And all you have to do is be a member, which, you know, does have a cost attached to it. $10 if you're a youth and $15 for seniors and $25 for individuals. But if you're a member, you can show your art. And then sometimes we have a color-based theme, like we did the Selfqua, which is Sohwet McCheen for water. That show was blue. Your work had to be at least 80% blue. And that makes a beautiful, cohesive show. But it was open to everyone, any age, doing any media. We like to have those shows because I think those are opportunities for us to build relationships again, right? People who may be working away, making cool things in their basement or at their kitchen table, don't otherwise have a chance to show in a gallery. So if we have these open shows that have a theme, you know, it might align with something they're doing and they'll just be, woohoo, I get to show my artwork. And it's empowering to do that.
When is this open?
Yes, Le'enk'tuch opens on July 6th. I think the delivery date would be just sometime at the end of June. The date's not super handy, but you can check our website. Yeah, so it'll be the July-August exhibition in 2024.
Your website is?
SalmonArmArtsCenter.ca. So Salmon Arm Arts, arts is plural. There's an S at the end of it. Center is spelled the Canadian way, and then .ca.
Thanks for coming in, Tracy.
It's been my pleasure, Jeanette. Like I could talk for 2 more hours about all the crazy things we do, but I really respect that you've made some time for us today and helped me share some of this information.
Wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you.